Hamlet, Romeo and Juliet, King Lear, Othello, Macbeth, Julius Caesar, Much Ado About Nothing, The Merchant of Venice. We know those plays by their author, by their director, Shakespeare. Every act, every scene, every line and dialogue bears the imprint of his pen. He is the creator behind all the characters, every plot twist, every ending. And yet, you never see Shakespeare himself in his own place. Yet his presence is pervasive, and you would know a Shakespearean play if you saw it. Isn't life kind of like that? A Shakespearean play where we believe that the hand of God is working in the background, but we are a part of the drama of life. We don't know where the story is often going. We don't know the plot twist, where it's going next, the ups and downs, but we wonder sometimes, is there something directing this grand play of life in the story of our lives? We believe our God is directing every scene. You can see the shadow, if you're looking, of the Almighty directing from the wings. And if we observe long enough and hard enough, we can even see his fingerprints all over the drama of life, even though he is unseen and often unheard. Can I ask you this morning, though, do you think life happens by chance or luck? Or do you believe the things in your life happen by design, the good, the bad, the ugly? Do you see God in the mundane of everyday life, or do you only see him in the miraculous? See, seldom in the scriptures and seldom in life do you see the Red Sea parted. Seldom in the scriptures or seldom in life do you see an angel showing up to communicate to you, or the loud voice of God being present. Seldom in the scriptures and seldom in life do you see a burning bush to give you direction. So here's the question: have you developed an attentiveness? An attentiveness to see God's hand working in the background, or do you just see God as absent, as unattentive to your needs? Or maybe, if you're honest, you don't think he's there at all. Turn with me to the book of Esther. It's page 410 in a Bible close to you. It's after Nehemiah, if it helps you, and before the book of Job and the historical books of Scripture. And the big picture of the book of Esther is this. It's the unseen hand of God. God working in the backdrop. The theological, $100 theological term for that is providence. God's unseen, invisible providence working in the background. As you turn there, a little context to help you know where we're going, where the scene goes, the first opening act goes in the book of Esther. If you remember, the people of God were given in the law commands to obey. And God said that there would be blessing if they obeyed, but if they didn't obey, there would be consequences, kind of like parenting. And yet, he also said one of the consequences would be if they don't obey and they go after other gods and they turn away from their God, God would scatter them. Remember, God promised them a land, a promised land, and he said, I will take you out of that land and I will scatter you, Israel. And that's exactly the redemptive story of the Old Testament with Israel. They continue to obey. They go after other gods, and God scatters them. And the way that God scatters them is bringing in other mighty nations, God using pagan nations to scatter them. In 586 BC, you see the Babylonians coming into Israel and coming into Jerusalem and taking over the city and desecrating the temple, and then they take the people of God to Babylon, and they are in exile. But then a bigger, stronger, mightier nation comes and swallows up Babylon. Anybody know who that is? It's the Persian Empire. They come and they swallow up the Babylonians, and the Jews are left there. even though that they have been unfaithful, God will still be faithful to his people. Aren't you glad? And he rescues them. He provides a way. So some of the Jews who are in exile are able, by the decree of a pagan king, because God works this way over kings and kingdoms, doesn't he? Allows them to come back with Ezra. You ever read the book of Ezra? They come back to the promised land. They come back to Jerusalem to rebuild the temple. And then after that, another wave of them comes back with Nehemiah. Remember him from about a year ago? And they come back and they build a wall around Jerusalem. But some of the exiles stay in Persia. They stay in functional captivity. They're exiled. They're not in their land. They are in Persia. And this is where we pick up this story of Esther and Mordecai. They are in exile still in Persia. Interestingly enough, the grand story is the Bible reminds us in Genesis 12 that he comes to Abram and he offers Abraham land, seed, and blessing. And he makes a statement, and God makes a statement to them in Genesis chapter 12. It says, through your seed, all the families of the earth will be blessed, which refers back to a promise in Genesis 3, where God will crush the serpent's heads, the first picture of the gospel that there will come one who will crush the serpent's head. But there's also an interesting little promise in this first gospel. It says the offspring of the woman will have enmity with the offspring of the serpent. So what you can see all the way through the Old Testament and New, you see the oppression of the Jewish people. Satan is after the Jewish people because not only because they have the promises of God, but the ultimate promise of God is going to come through the seed of the woman, Messiah. And so if you trace the Old Testament, what do you think the evil one is trying to do in the Exodus? In slavery, he's trying to destroy the people of God in which Messiah would come. You come to the time of Jesus in Bethlehem, and what is Herod trying to do? What is the evil one trying to do? He's trying to cut off the line of Messiah who will save the people from their sins. Did you know there was another place in the Old Testament where the line of Messiah and the people of God could have been cut off? The Holocaust, before the Holocaust, if you will, a genocide of God's people, right here, the book of Esther. Today, as we begin our study of Esther, the most interesting thing to me about the book is that the word, the name of God, is never mentioned. It's never mentioned anywhere in the book. Kind of like a Shakespearean play where you never see Shakespeare, the author, the director, the playwright, mentioned. See, God, though, is the playwright at work in the shadow of the wings, of his wings. Esther, like no other book in the Bible, much like our own lives, is an invitation to see God's unseen hand working in our waiting, teaching us, as the song would say, to trust. You see, in Esther, there's no Red Sea parting. In Esther, there's no angelic visitation. There's no loud voice from heaven. There's no burning bush. Just God's unseen, unheard, providential working in the background, working out his promises for his people. And so, with all that said, your overarching truth that jumps off the page all the way through the book of Esther is this. I'm going to give you the theological version, then I'm going to give you the street level version. Our invisible God is our invincible God, working out his providential plan. Here's the street level. Even when it feels like God is absent or distant, he's at work. This is the message of the book of Esther. I'd encourage you this week, if it's been a while since you've read the book of Esther, to read it all the way through, because you're going to, kind of like life, you've got to read the whole thing and understand the whole thing to look back and go, oh, there's God, there's God, there's God, and there's God. I encourage you to do that. The Cliff Note version is this: King Xerxes is the brazen, and we're going to see today, great king of Persia, and he wants everybody to know about it. He likes throwing feasts. He likes throwing drunken feasts. He makes bad decisions when he's drunk having feasts. He asks his then wife, Queen Vashti, to come out and parade around so everybody could see her beauty, and she says no. He disposes of her. For 2 years, he looks for a queen, and he finds the star, Esther. Little does he know, she's Jewish. And she becomes his queen. Mordecai, the other player in the story, a Jewish man who's functionally adopted Esther, he foils a plot to kill the king. People were trying to kill the king. Haman notices. Haman, the villain in the act, in the story, in the play, knows that Mordecai's a Jew, and he begins to hate him because he's not even a Persian. He's a Canaanite, and he hates the Jews who've extinguished most of his people. And Haman, the right-hand man of King Xerxes, decides he's going to take out Mordecai, and if he has to, he will take out all the Jews. And then God has placed little Esther in this place for such a time as this, that she might, through the Lord's providential plan, strength and dignity and courage to go before the king and save her people. And there's all kinds of irony in here. There's all kinds of reversals in the story. It's not Mordecai who dies at the gallows. It's Haman who dies at the gallows that he made for Mordecai. God working. So as you read, as I'd encourage you to do this story, I want you to notice, as you read it this week, the coincidences, the lucky situations that happen. I made a list. Maybe this will tell a little of the story. Esther just happens to be Jewish, and she just happens to be beautiful. Esther just happens to be favored by the king. Mordecai just happens to overhear the plot against the king's life. A report of this just happens to be written in the king's chronicles. Haman just happens to notice that Mordecai doesn't kneel down before him, and he just happens to find out that Mordecai is a Jew. When Haman plots his revenge, the dice just happens to indicate that the date for his exacting revenge is put off by almost a year. Esther just happens to get the king's approval to speak, but then she happens to put off her request for another day. Her deferral just happens to send Haman out by Mordecai one more time, which just happens to cause him to recount it to his friends. Are we done yet? They in turn just happen to encourage him to build a scaffold or a gallows immediately. So Haman just happens to be excited to approach the king early the next morning, and it just happens that the previous night the king could not command a moment's sleep, and it just happens that he had a book brought to him that recounted Mordecai's deed that he had forgotten. Haman happens to approach the king just when the king is wondering how Mordecai should be honored. Later on, the king just happens to return to the queen just when Haman happens to be pleading with Esther in a way that can be misconstrued. And last, the gallows Haman built for Mordecai just happens to be ready when King Xerxes wants to hang Haman. Are those all coincidences in this play, in this drama? I don't think so. No such thing, y'all, as luck. Not in God's economy. There's no such thing as coincidence. This is God's providence. Remember the verses in the New Testament, Ephesians 1, 10, and 11. He works how many things to the counsel of his will? All things. Think about all things. That's everything, good, bad, indifferent. Jesus, Colossians 1, holds all things together. Romans 8, if we couldn't forget it, the verse that's hard to read sometimes, in the most difficult of places, Romans 8, 28, and we know that God works all things for good for those who love him and are called according to his promise. You know what God did? I gave you a big word, providence, God's providence. That word in Latin comes from two words, providere. Pro means for or before. Videre means I see. Put those together. Before I see. See, God not only knows what's going to happen and sees it before it happens, he's also working for it to happen. And there's some irony in that statement because when I'm struggling with the things in my life and understanding them, I want to know what I'm seeing that I can't see, that I can't understand. God's providence. Ever been through something hard? You can't see the outcome and you ask God, but let's say some time goes on. Sometimes you can look back and go, you know what? That 5-year period that was brutal in my life where this happened and this happened and this happened, I can begin to see God's providential hand in it. But it's a lot harder when you're in the play, isn't it? It's the way the book of Esther is as we read back. John Flavel, the popular Puritan pastor, Robbie's not even here. He's on vacation. He likes the Puritan stuff, right? John Flavel says this about God's providence. I love this. God's providence is like a Hebrew word. You have to read it from back to front. Hebrews, right? To left. From back to front, you've got to get through it to look back and see it. Can I ask you this morning, just by way of application, is there anything that you can't see that you go, what is going on in my life because this is happening that's got you questioning God's presence, God's power, God's care, God's work in your life? And Esther is a great invitation. It's a great invitation that when we lack answers to hard questions, to know that God is there, to know that he is working even in the unseen. And you go, well, that doesn't seem that fair, that I have to wait. Why would God do that? Well, why would God put his son Jesus on a cross? Do you remember what Jesus said? God, would you take, Father, would you take this cup from me, but not my will, but yours be done. Did the Father take the cup of what was coming and what was happening from the Son? He didn't. He was pleased, the Bible says, to crush him, but look at what came out of it. Glory for the Son and grace for you and me. I want to show you the first 9 verses. See, even when it feels God is absent or distant, the book of Esther teaches us that he is at work. I wanted you to see the first 9 verses today as we open this book, mostly background to really help you understand how great Xerxes really thought he was, to really help you understand the context of how challenging it would be to see, is God going to work in this hard situation with this great superpower, the Persian Empire and the greatness of the king? Look at it with me. Esther chapter 1, verse 1 through 9. Now in the days of Ahasuerus, that's the Hebrew for the Greek word Xerxes, the Ahasuerus who reigned from India, that's present-day Pakistan, to Ethiopia, which is present-day Sudan. That's a pretty large area to Rome. Over 127 provinces within about 20 nations. In those days when King Ahasuerus sat on his royal throne in Susa, the citadel, in the 3rd year of his reign, he gave a feast. Lots of feasts in the book of Esther, if you like parties. For all his officials and servants, the army of Persia and Media, and the nobles and governors of the provinces were before him while he showed the riches of his royal glory. Oh. And the splendor and pomp of his greatness for many days, 180 days, that's half a year. It's quite a party. And when these days were completed, the king gave for all the people present in Susa, the citadel, both great and small, another party, a feast, lasting for 7 days. And in the court of the garden of the king's palace, there was, look at all this, opulence, white cotton curtains, violet hangings fastened with cords of fine linen, picture this, and purple with silver rods, and marble pillars, and also couches of gold and silver on the mosaic pavement, porphyry, marble, mother of pearl, and precious stones. Drinks were served in golden vessels, likely the vessels from the temple in Jerusalem, vessels of different kinds, and the royal wine was lavished according to the bounty of the king. And drinking was according to this edict. There's no compulsion, for the king had given orders to all the staff of the palace to do as each man desired. Enter Queen Vashti. Queen Vashti also gave a feast for the women in the palace that belonged to King Ahasuerus, or Xerxes. Your second thought this morning is this, and then we're going to unpack it. As exiles, as the Jews were here, God's people shouldn't be captivated by worldly arrogance, abundance, and authority. I think you see all three of those things as we look through the text. I want to show them to you. It's interesting. The author of Esther, which is not said and unknown, some people speculate it's Mordecai or other, the author of Esther goes to extraordinary lengths here to show us the power and opulence of the Persian king and the kingdom. And I think he does that, or she does that, on purpose. Is God able to work against such power? I mean, the Persians were the superpower of the day. They had overtaken the Babylonians. You ever seen the movie 300? Don't judge. Men, it's bloody, right? You probably not let your 10-year-old watch it yet, fellas. Maybe on, unless it's modified. 300. It's set actually in a time just at the end of Xerxes' reign, just after this, because Xerxes had already, and Persia had already taken over like the Babylonians, and they were coming for the Greeks. They were coming for the Greek world. And you see, if you've ever seen that movie, they do a really good job of showing the might and the power of the Persian army, like the sun goes dark when the Persian army is approaching. The ground shakes, and the Spartans are like, what is that? And it's the Persian army approaching. And then you see the arrogance of King Xerxes. Xerxes comes down to Leonidas. What's his name? Leonidas. Hey, help me out. Help me out. I always get quizzed on this. If I get the Bible right and I get this wrong, it's okay. And he has all this royal guard and opulence, and he's so arrogant. He has all this authority. Kneel to me, the God. It's a good picture. Accurate, I don't know. A good picture, though, of the power of a kingdom and the power of a king in that day. And yet we know, right? We know from the scriptures that God is not impressed. Psalm 2. God laughs in the heavens at kings. He's like, they're pawns, but we're pretty impressed. We're pretty fearful of those in power, but not God. Look at King Xerxes, particularly in verses 1 through 3. We know him from history as a pretty brutal despot. He ruled this vast kingdom that was growing. He was the supreme, you could say the supreme leader really of the world in that day. 180 days, a feast for 180 days, half a year, a party for half a year. Who's there? Who does he invite? He invites functionally his military and politicians. And likely, if these are all the leaders of those different 127 provinces, it's probably a come and go party, I'm going to guess. But they invite him there. You know why they don't invite him there, though? Xerxes didn't invite him there to go, hey, thank you so much for your sacrifice. I want to celebrate you. He didn't invite them there to celebrate their victories. He brought them there, verse 4, for what purpose? Before him, while he showed the riches of whose royal glory? His. The splendor and pomp of Persia? No. His greatness. You see the incredible arrogance of this king. I'm inviting you here because I want you to experience how great I am. I want you to see my power and my glory and my greatness. Half a year to celebrate the king and all of his greatness. One commentator said the invitation to this party might have looked like this. Dear important person, your presence is commanded at the king's feast to give you the opportunity to bask in his glory and greatness and to show you what true extravagance and power looks like. What a privilege this will be for you. Feel it? Please drop by the palace between noon and midnight any day over the next 6 months, or stay for the entire time. Also, please do not send your regrets. Your presence will be your everlasting, your absence will be your everlasting regret. See you soon. You ever been around someone? Here we go. You ever been around someone who repeatedly informed you how great they were? Directly or indirectly, you enjoy being around those kind of people? Do you enjoy kind of like listening to the joint session of Congress a few weeks ago? The greatness of someone? I watched for about 30 minutes. That was all I could handle. Ever thrown a party to celebrate yourself? Maybe not. Maybe we've grown up and we know not to do that. But if you're honest, and I'm honest, I'm not so different than Xerxes. I want others to know about me. I want others to appreciate me. I want others to know me. And I'm guilty of sprinkling my own accomplishments ever so slightly into conversations, are you? Or my positions or my achievements. Because I fear that people won't see me and affirm me. It may not be the power and prominence of Xerxes, but don't we often crave to be acknowledged? I think we do. But you know the remedy for that, for me and for you? See, what I'm considering, my own glory, my own greatness in my own mind, what I need to do is consider God's greatness. See, it's hard to consider how great I am when I'm considering how great God is. And when I do that, the fears of worldly evils and power structures of my day also fade when I'm considering the greatness and the power of God. Living in a world that I fear. You know, when I'm considering the greatness of my God and his Son, it's hard to be impressed with any earthly kind of arrogance, isn't it? When I'm worshiping him, when I'm opening his word and being reminded of his providence and his greatness, it's hard to think of my own. It's hard to fear others in power. It's hard to be impressed with the arrogance and the glory of the world, isn't it? That's our remedy. But every party, apparently, needs an after party. Do you see it? Verse 5 through 7, look at it. It was only a week. All right, that sounds like a long party to me. I'm ready to go to bed, 9:30. A week. Who's it for? It's for the citizens. You know what the citizens in Persia do? They take care of all this stuff. They build all this stuff. They're the ones that are working. I'm sure they wanted to spend another week celebrating the opulence that they probably created. What do you think? But that's what he does. There's a feast, 7 days, and look at all the opulence, look at all the stuff, cotton curtains, hangings, linens, pillars, couches, gold, the accumulation. Look at it all. He's lying really to himself about his identity, isn't he? We do that. I am what I have, and I need you to see it and approve of it and know how glorious I am because I have it. How many of these items lasted? Not a one. It reminds me a couple of weeks ago when we were talking about generosity. A devoted disciple is generous. And we studied the rich young ruler, and rather than receiving the treasure, which was Jesus himself, he walked away because of his own treasure and his own wealth. He got it backwards. And then you see verse 8 and 9, look at it. We go from the drapes to the drinks. And drinking was according to this edict. I didn't know I needed to take, you know, to take a sip of something that I needed a royal decree. It seems kind of weird. There is no compulsion, meaning you can drink as you want to. The king given orders for all the staff of his palace to do as each one desired. Oh, thank you so much, megalomaniac king, right? Like, if you live in a society where you can't take a drink of anything without the king telling you when you can do it, if you can do it, how you do it, how much you do it. Maybe sometimes when you go to parties, people need that. Man, that is total control, isn't it? That's what he wants. Total control. We don't understand this. Maybe the kids are like, I do. My mom and dad. Just kidding. That's right. It's not a democracy, y'all. You ever said that to your kids? We'll have therapy later. You ever been somewhere where there wasn't the level of freedom that you have that you didn't? I mean, here we don't even think about such things. We live in one of the freest societies and countries the world has ever known. And we have more freedom than we've ever had, just FYI. There are plenty of problems with our country. This is a rabbit hole. But freedom isn't one of them. We were coming back, bringing Samuel back from Ethiopia. We had to go through Saudi Arabia. You ever touched down on Saudi soil or been there or been to places that are more dictatorial? Man, the flight attendants are taking up drinks. They're taking up any magazine, including their own, like for pictures or whatever. Like the level of control. We touched down. Officials from Saudi Arabia came in the plane. All we're doing, we're on the tarmac. We're not hanging out in Saudi Arabia, but we're in the kingdom. And the kingdom had rules, had edicts for the littlest of things. That was a freaky feeling. It wasn't just a freaky feeling. It was oppressive to feel that. You ever been somewhere like that? This is what the people in Persia lived under. This is what the Jews in Persia who are in exile are living under. A micromanaging megalomaniac that wanted people to be in awe and reverence, to adore and be subject to him. But he's going to find out that he may be able to control the citizens. He may be able to control the military. He may be able to control the politicians in this way, or at least at surface value in this way. But he's about to find out that he can't control his wife. Next week, fellas, y'all need to come. Ladies, too. He can't control his wife. He also doesn't control God being the one who's actually pulling the strings. He's in for a rude awakening. This is meant to set us up for what God is going to do to this king who is arrogant, who is great in his own eyes. Set him up for the abundance in which he has, to set him up to understand who God is. Well, no matter what the circumstances, what we're going to see is that God has you in the place that you're in, with the people that you're around, for his purposes and his promises that are sure. The question really that we need to ask ourselves is, do we trust him? Do you trust God to go before you, in front of you, behind you, before you can see his providence? A father wanted to teach his son to trust him, to trust in what he was telling. So he gave him an object lesson and he calls him over, and the father says to the son, the father holds out a set of keys to his son. In front of him, he's standing a few feet away. And he says to the son, no matter what, these keys, in the lesson, these keys will always be before you, right before you. So then he turns to his son after saying this, and he says, where are the keys? And the son rolls his eyes, and he says, well, they're in front of me, Dad. How do you know? And the son says, because I can see them. Duh. The father takes a blindfold, puts it over his son's eyes, so he can't see. And he rattles the keys in front of him. And he asks the son, where are the keys? They're in front of me. How do you know? He says, I can hear them. Father steps back a few feet. Kid is blindfolded. And he says, son, where are the keys? And the son begins to move his hands around, and the father's still close enough, and he grasps the keys. He feels the keys. Where are the keys? They're still before me. How do you know? I know because I feel them. I can touch them. I can't see them. I can't hear them, but I can touch them. And then the father, in the final play of the object lesson, backs up a few more feet. Son still blindfolded, can't see, far enough away that he can't feel. And he says, son, where are the keys? And son begins to move his hands around. He can't find the keys. And the son says, I don't know. And the father said, where did I tell you in the beginning where the keys would always be? And the son said, in front of me. So the father asked, where do you think the keys are? And the son says, in front of me. See, there are times in our lives where we do not see God. We can't hear God. We can't feel God. And yet, he has promised to never leave us or forsake us. Our trust in his presence is not based on what we can see, hear, touch, or feel, like Esther. Your takeaway today is simply trust and promise in God's promised providence. That's a lot of P's. Trust in his providence. Before I see, I can know that God is before me, in front of me, behind me. He will never leave us or forsake us. Let me pray. Father, would you, by your Spirit, would you allow us to trust in days in which we can't see, we can't hear, we can't touch? Would we trust by faith that you are working in the good days and in the bad days? Would you show us through your word and by your Spirit in the community of faith that we live in that you are a trustworthy God? That you don't leave us hanging, that you are there in our midst, that you are working in the backdrop, even when we think things that are happening are not for our good, but we can know that they're for your purpose and ultimately our good. We love you and we thank you for a message. While your name is not present in the book of Esther anywhere, you are inviting us to see your providential hand working in the backdrop in our lives. We love you and we thank you that you're a God that does not leave us or forsake us. In Jesus' name, amen.